This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. The Women's World Cup is underway in France, and we're going to spend much of this hour telling stories about women and soccer and equity. And we might as well start here. The United States has fielded a national women's soccer team since the mid-1980s.
During those three decades, they've been ranked number one most of the time. So that's a record of excellence going back 30 years.
That's Jeffrey Gerson. He teaches sports and politics at UMass Lowell. And he's right. The U.S. women rock. Three world championships, four Olympic golds.
But their achievements on the field are equally matched by their achievements off the field.
Reporter Ken Schulman has that story.
It started in December 1995. The team was in Chula Vista, California, training for the 1996 Atlanta Summer Games. It was the first time women would play soccer at the Olympics, and nine of the team's top players weren't at camp. They were locked out in a contract dispute. One of them was Christine Lilly.
We were all scared.
Led by co-captains Julie Foudy and Carla Overbeck, the nine players spoke frequently via conference call.
I remember one time saying, Jules, I don't know, I'm really scared that I won't play in the Olympics. And she's like, oh, I am too, but this is going to make a difference.
They couldn't lock out all of us from the Olympics.
That's Julie Foudy.
But we have to stay in it now, because if they start pulling us apart, then we're done.
Breaking up this group wouldn't be easy. Foudy and Lilly were all of 24, but they and their fellow holdouts had been together for a while. 8 years earlier in 1987, Foudy, Lilly, Joy Fawcett, and Mia Hamm were at an under-19 national team retreat in the Midwest.
The head coach of the national team was Anson Dorrance, and he came into a room and he's like, I would like you guys to join the U.S. women's national team. And I just sat there for a second because I'm like, I have to ask my parents.
2 months later, Lilly was playing in China, where the 16-year-old became the youngest national team player to score a goal. She and her teammates traveled the globe. Writers called them the Title IX babies. The conditions weren't great. They played in baggy hand-me-downs from the men. When they flew,
we get our tickets and everyone's like, who's in the middle? And everyone raised their hand. And right down the middle of the plane is all of us sitting there. You know, and you can see because we're all in the same colored shirts.
You would just see a strip of red going up every middle seat.
That's Julie Foudy again.
Or we were rows 44 and 45, and 46 was smoking back in the days. So you'd be essentially sitting in the smoking section going over to Europe.
In 1991, the team won the first Women's World Championship. FIFA wasn't ready to call it a World Cup yet. The players were thrilled to wear red, white, and blue. So what if a little smoke got in their eyes? But it was more than that.
We're staying in these dumpy hotels, and we're hearing about the men's team staying in these nice hotels, and we're getting $10 a day and no salary.
Alan Rothenberg was president of U.S. soccer at the time of that world championship. He'd taken the post a year earlier, in 1990.
Well, when I came on as president of the United States Soccer Federation, I didn't even know we had a women's team.
Rothenberg says the federation had virtually no money, but they'd scraped together enough for a training camp and small per diems to help the women prepare for the 1991 tournament.
The men's team, by the way, had next to no funds as well. But shortly after I became president of the federation, we created a camp and paid the men to get ready for the 1994 World Cup.
Soccer was beginning to gain traction in the U.S., but the women still felt like second-class citizens. Julie Foudy says one time the team had to take a Holiday Inn shuttle to a game.
We used to label it as character building in the beginning, and then you start to get to a point where you're like, okay, we're full of character now. We're overflowing with character. Let's move on this.
Let's move. But how? The team turned to tennis great Billie Jean King. King knew all about character and discrimination. In 1973, as defending U.S. Open champion, King threatened to boycott the tournament unless the women received the same prize money as the men. That same year, she defeated Bobby Riggs in the famous Battle of the Sexes. King mentored the U.S. women. She was especially close to Foudy.
She used to say, you have this blank canvas, and it's not what you're building for you, it's what are you building for the next generation. So think about how you want it to be for them. And that was what we always kept in mind when we were in labor negotiations.
My name is Ellen Zavian, and I'm a sports attorney and a professor at George Washington University.
Ellen Zavian was the first female attorney to represent NFL players. She'd been doing it for nearly a decade when Foudy and Team USA co-captain Carla Overbeck asked her for help with their contracts.
These athletes had been together for so long that they came to me very unified.
We did so much stuff together off the field.
Christine Lilly.
Because there was no computers, there's no cell phones. We were reading books, we were playing cards, we were playing board games. It's just a different time, and that built camaraderie, trust, love for each other.
In late 1995, with the Olympics just over the horizon, the nine women got new contracts from the Federation. According to these contracts, the women would only receive an Olympic bonus if they took gold in Atlanta. The men would get bonuses for gold, silver, or bronze. Following Ellen Zavian's advice, Foudy, Lilly, and their teammates crossed out the contested clauses, then faxed their contracts back to U.S. Soccer. In response, U.S. Soccer canceled their invitations to the Chula Vista training camp. The Federation didn't know it, but Zavian says the lockout was part of her plan.
I very much wanted a lockout because the public looks at strikes as players whining. And I had been through an 87 strike with NFL players where there were scabs. So from that experience, I realized that a lockout actually brings the media and the fans much more supportive of the players.
The nine locked out players and Ellen Zavian dug in for what looked like a long standoff.
And then somewhere along the line, I got a call at like 6 a.m. from Alan, who was on the West Coast. And he started screaming at me, just literally screaming at me, which I was used to with general managers and football teams, but this was at another level.
For the record, Rothenberg says he doesn't remember the phone call.
No, but I'm sure it happened. I don't doubt her.
I got off the phone and called a friend of mine, and I said to him, this guy just screamed and yelled at me. And his immediate reply was, when they're screaming, they're going down. So just hold out.
He was right. A few weeks later, the Federation folded its cards. The women would receive bonuses for gold, silver, or bronze. The players also got paid pregnancy leave, severance pay, additional performance bonuses, and paid nannies for two players who had small children. The nine holdouts returned to the team in early 1996 and started to get ready for the Olympics. The women took gold in Atlanta. For Christine Lilly, the victory was sweet.
That was always our goal, and to stand on that podium with gold medals and being like, yes, we did it. We did it for us, but for the rest, the next generation and others. I mean, you win and make a statement like that, that's huge. It's huge.
I would say one other thing.
Team attorney Ellen Zavian.
I will never forget when the soccer players put a ton of gold medals on my neck and said they couldn't get here without me.
If you let me play.
If you let me play sports.
I will like myself more.
I'll have more self-confidence.
If you let me play sports.
This Nike ad captured the infectious spirit the U.S. women had unleashed. Their Olympic gold put soccer on the national map, along with women's sports. The U.S. was scheduled to host the next Women's World Cup in 1999. FIFA wanted to play the matches in small stadiums and just in the Northeast, but Rothenberg and the Federation stepped up big.
We petitioned FIFA and said, we have enough confidence in this team and in this country that we think we can put the World Cup on for the women in the big stadiums in the major cities, just like we had done for the men in 94. FIFA basically said, okay, go ahead and do it. They gave us virtually no financial support.
That was a huge risk that they took.
UMass Lowell professor Jeff Gerson.
And it paid off tremendously. They sold out Giant Stadium. They sold out the Rose Bowl, 90,000 plus people. They went beyond anyone's wildest dreams.
It means that the USA could win the World Cup on this next kick. Chastain will take it.
The PK heard round the world. Olympic champions, world champions for a second time. It was 1999, and the team was peaking. These young women played great soccer. They were personable and articulate, but the fight wasn't over. Nike and Gatorade had signed on as sponsors for the U.S. Soccer Federation. Their marquee player? Mia Hamm, star striker for the women's team. But even with a woman as the face of American soccer, the Federation poured most of its resources into the men's team, which lost all three of its matches at the 1998 World Cup. It was time to turn up the heat. The 2000 Summer Olympics weren't far off, and Julie Foudy felt the balance of power shifting.
This market that they kept telling us didn't exist, which was always their first argument they would go to, they being U.S. soccer, was something we just proved to be wrong.
On to the next round of collective bargaining. This time their lawyer was Philadelphia sports attorney John Langle. Langle first met the team at a training camp in Greensboro, South Carolina. After two decades spent representing world-class pro athletes, he thought he was done with being starstruck.
I walked in the room and I saw it was a room full of 20, 25 women who, in the course of an hour, told me how dynamic they were, how passionate they were, how smart they were, how they were visionaries and saw long into the future. And by the time I left the meeting, the hairs on my arms were standing straight up.
After the World Cup victory in 1999, the U.S. women found their own sponsor and started planning their own victory tour. 12 matches in 12 U.S. cities. The players, some of whom earned just $9,000 a year from U.S. soccer, would pocket hefty bonuses. The Federation, which was planning its own victory tour for the team, wasn't happy. Yet after a few days of meetings, they folded again. Along with the right to hold their own victory tour, the players won better salaries, more generous bonuses, improved training facilities, and massage therapists. Julie Foudy says these negotiations were even more impactful than the 96 Olympic tug of war.
Suddenly, in the negotiation, tenor changed drastically. And our demands changed drastically in terms of market and equitable support.
Today, the path cut by the 99 team serves as a roadmap for national teams around the world fighting for gender equity. But the fight goes on at home. In March, a few months before this summer's Women's World Cup in France, the defending champion U.S. team filed a gender discrimination suit against U.S. soccer.
It's not only about leaving our sport in a better place, leaving it better for the young girls that will come after, but just in general, inspiring women around the world.
Julie Foudy has taken the baton from Billie Jean King and serves as mentor to other female athletes in their fight for parity. Yet as inspiring as the canvas Foudy and her teammates helped to paint might be, she says the work is still unfinished.
It's taken 20 years for us to be able to even say we're at a tipping point for women's soccer. So that's where I get frustrated and that it wasn't as speedy a catalyst as I had hoped.
In 2011, 23 years after she asked her parents' permission to join the U.S. national team, Christine Lilly hung up her cleats. Today she runs soccer and training camps and recently published a book on leadership. Oh, and she coaches her two young daughters' soccer teams.
They know mommy won medals, but to them, I'm mom, and their favorite players are Alex Morgan, Megan Rapinoe, Tobin Heath. So mommy's like, okay.
This year, nearly 20 years since their 1999 World Cup triumph, Lilly and her former teammates held a reunion in Los Angeles. The 99ers watched a workout and took photos on the field with the women who now represent the U.S. Many of the current players told Lilly how they'd always looked up to the 99 team. "That's great," Lilly replied, "because now our kids look up to you."
That's reporter Ken Shulman. Jeffrey Gerson provided planning and production help for this story. He's the author of An Oral History of the Fight for Gender Equity in U.S. Women's Soccer. Christine Lilly is the author of Powerhouse, 13 Teamwork Tactics That Build Excellence and Unrivaled Success. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef. Traceability so bold that customers can even know the genetic pedigree of their steak or burger. From a six-generation family ranch in the Nebraska Sandhills, Honest Beef is dedicated to telling the story of your beef. Follow along on Instagram to see their life on the ranch, working to provide their customers with high-quality, dry-aged beef that they can feel great about. From their ranch to your door, they'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
Is there age discrimination from employers?
What is it about paying in advance that makes people faster at picking up their dry cleaning?
I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Cardiff Garcia. We are the co-hosts of Planet Money's The Indicator, where we answer these great questions from you, our listeners.
Every day, and in less than 10 minutes.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. Team USA is in France, looking to repeat as Women's World Cup champions, with maybe a little bit of help from a very young phenom, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Bleacher Report's Miren Fader and Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks for having me, Karen.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Miren, tell us about this young phenom.
So I profiled Mallory Pugh for Bleacher Report's BR Mag, and sure, it's a story about a 21-year-old phenom, somebody with incredible speed, incredible playmaking ability, but, you know, what it's really about is how hard it is to be a prodigy, how much pressure and expectations there are on young people, and it's only getting worse. I mean, I think the emphasis on young and young and young has really hit women's soccer. Recently, Olivia Moultrie, a 13-year-old, turned pro. And Mallory Pugh entered the national stage at 14. So what you have here is this dynamic where the expectations are only getting bigger. And what I realized in talking with Mallory is that it really affects her psyche. She's in a battle with herself, constantly questioning, you know, am I good enough to be here? Most of us are not our most confident selves at 21, and Mallory's story and Olivia's story really cause us to question, you know, what's the effect of putting so much emphasis and weight on our younger players, and how does it really affect their mental health?
One of the things we're studying a lot is this whole idea of transitions, and at the heart of the problem we've determined is starting that transition concept as early as possible, getting every athlete to be clear, it's not going to last forever, what are you going to do next? And part of the problem with getting athletes to do that is the culture that says, if you think about anything else, you're not thinking about whatever it is you're playing. So it's thrilling to see these young people be successful, but it's also kind of on the tightrope kind of feeling of, well, what's going to happen when the end of the career comes.
My first reaction to all of this is to really feel terrible about the pressures we put on these very, very young athletes, especially for me when it comes to the choice of whether to play in college or turn pro, because for 99.9% of college-aged women's soccer players, the absolute right answer is to go to college. And for those very, very few, very, very elite players, college isn't the right choice, but that feels like a very lonely decision to make. I mean, when I was reading your piece, Miren, that is the main sense that I felt, was not so much the pressure, but the real loneliness that Mallory felt as she was sort of pulled away from her support systems and pushed out on her own, really kind of maybe before she was entirely ready for that. But on the other hand, whenever female athletes are subjected to the same pressures that male athletes have been subjected to for decades, I kind of do a little happy dance. Is it just me?
It's hard, right? You want to celebrate the fact that they have this opportunity to go pro and get the things that, you know, come with being a pro. But the money is so not the same for women that it is for men. So the incentive is different. And I think talking with Mallory, like, she used the word lost, and I think that's really hard because a lot of these young prodigies are supposed to feel anything but lost. They're put on this one track for all of their lives, and for her, she had to figure out her way, and we don't really talk about the growing pains that come with it.
Ken, you're up.
My story is about Kevin Warren, the new commissioner of the Big Ten. He's the first African-American commissioner of the Big Ten, first African-American commissioner of a Power Five college conference. It really is a moment to celebrate, and I kind of have this awkward thing about celebrating African-American gender, all these firsts just still make me kind of uneasy. So maybe it's a moment to acknowledge. As Kevin gets this job, and he's a wonderful guy, I've known him for years, he leaves a job as a COO of the Minnesota Vikings, and he was the highest-ranking African-American with a team in the National Football League. And this is a league... Somebody said this the other day, which I thought was a great way to phrase it. It's easier to find a former black president of the United States than it is of an NFL football team. So it's a very interesting moment to see what the NFL does. To me, it should be pretty revealing that once again we have this presence of people of color on the field of play, But the closer you get to the real money, the less likely you are to see a person of color. And losing Kevin, Kevin has one great job, moves to another, it's going to be interesting to see if someone else comes in and if the league has more of a wake-up call than it's had about the absence of African-Americans in this president position.
Yeah, I agree. I hope they use this as an opportunity to, you know, make sure a person of color fills that role. And I think also it was really cool to see that in the articles about him and this job, he said, you know, I want to make sure that I open up doors for other people, and knowing that it's not just this position, but, you know, hopefully inspires others to follow suit as well.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, Ken, in a league where maybe 70% of the players are African-American, the NFL now has zero top executives with teams who are Black, just one Black GM and three Black head coaches. And that's pretty pitiful. But I wanted to ask you about something else, which is we all know that the NFL has a terrible track record when it comes to diversity, but so does the NCAA, you know? And Kevin Warren will now be in a position, it feels like, to make some real changes in a space that needs some real changes.
Absolutely. There's such a long way to go. But the key to this, and the key with race issues, gender issues, sexual preference issues, is that there is this diversity in the room where decisions are being made. And to be in the room where these Power Five commissioners are making these determinations about pay for athletes, about where funding should go, about the new media rights deals, to have Kevin in there and to know, and he is that guy that will be no nonsense about any race issues going askew in the conversation. So that's wonderful. And again, too, if we give everybody the benefit of the doubt, we should give them. There are many people that have not had close relationships with people that are different from them. Mm-hmm. And for these crusty old guys, and a few exceptions, to have moments with Kevin will be a good thing. To say, oh, if somebody can do the job, they can do the job. Let's look for the best candidate in a way that we have not before.
All right. Until this week, I had never heard of Charles Glenn, but that was before I read a profile in the New York Times and then immediately went to YouTube to hear him sing.
In the rocket red glare, the bombs bursting in a
Charles Glenn has been the anthemist for the St. Louis Blues for 19 years, and he will belt out that song just one more time on Sunday night before Game 6 of the NHL Finals. Unlike other professional sports teams, a lot of NHL teams feature the same singer over and over again. In Boston for many years, it was this guy named Rene Rancourt, and if it wasn't for his real deep connection with Bruins fans, I would never have experienced what was, for me, the best national anthem of my life, which was just days after the Boston Marathon bombing, and Rancourt came out onto the ice, sang the first three words, and then conducted the fans to sing the anthem themselves. It was absolutely beautiful. And so I'm wondering, does the NHL get this right, or would you rather see minor celebrities and youth choirs serving up the national anthem?
You know, you got me. I've been trying, since you first brought this to my attention, I've been trying to figure out my preference on this. And the rendition is wonderful. This guy is going to be sorely missed. As a business person, the cost efficiency of having the same person and you don't have the person where you have to have the coach that'll come out and help them remember the words or whatever, those incidents that we see over and over again. So I say I'm you know, it's the Mona Lisa to me. Sometimes it looks good, sometimes it doesn't. I think it's okay.
Mirren, do you come down more strongly on one side or the other?
I actually really like this concept of it being one guy. I mean, this guy had a hell of a run. It's incredible. It's almost like athletes, you know, we go to the games, we look forward to seeing them, we feel this connection to them, even though we actually have no connection to them. But I like that you feel like you can. I feel like bringing the same person makes me feel that special feeling.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Bleacher Report's Mirren Fader and Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State's Global Sport Institute. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you, Karen. Mr. Decision Maker here.
As As you're getting ready to support the women in this World Cup, remember, you can also support Only a Game by subscribing to our podcast at Apple, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. After you hit subscribe, feel free to celebrate by shouting, "Goal!" Or leave us a review. That's probably less weird. The minimum salary in the NWSL, the top women's soccer league in the U.S., went up this year to $16,538. Even for a player who stays with a host family and gets transportation assistance from her team, it's not easy to live off $16,538 a year. But in some leagues in other countries, women earn better wages. Georgia Klopfel spent a season playing in South Korea. Here's Georgia.
A glossary. Apa, sick. Chua, cold. Pegupa, hungry. These are the first Korean words I learn. I arrive in January. Snow clouds clear our training fields on the eastern coast of Korea. The sub-zero wind bites my naked hands, and on the second morning, a teammate gives me a pair of her gloves. We live in a hotel for 6 weeks of preseason. There's a sullen heaviness to our trainings, which are every day of the week, twice. Himdro, they teach me. Difficult. For most of the season, we live in Incheon, South Korea, on a man-made island in the Yellow Sea. The waves reach the edge of our dormitory, which is secured by a gate and three security guards. Some pollution blows across the ocean from Beijing, but some of it I can see wafting up into the sky across the bay from factories in Seoul. When the sky is blue, it is blue only above my head in a vertical strip. Most days, the horizon is cushioned by a yellow-gray haze. The guards bike in circles to patrol the area around the field and housing. During my first week, the oldest one pulls me aside on my way out to the training field, proudly showing off the translation apps he has on his phone. He speaks into the microphone, and his phone speaks to me.
What is your name?
I speak back. My name's Georgia. And he smiles as he reads the transcribed Korean. In South Korea, athletes give up most of their formal education at the age of 12. Starting then, their sport is their main focus. They often train three times a day. Upon graduation, female soccer players hope to secure a spot on one of the teams that make up the professional league. Here, they can make a more stable wage than is offered almost anywhere in the world to female players. Even my teammates who speak no English can say at least one word, fighting. I learn quickly that fighting can mean stay strong, it can mean suck it up, it can mean chin up, it can mean cheer up, it can mean move on, it can mean play hard or let's go. There's a certain strength here in hiding emotion, in fighting through most things instead of fighting for them. I spend my first few nights getting to know my new teammates. Via Google Translate, I ignorantly ask them what they studied in school.
Soccer.
Only soccer. I ask what they'll do after they stop playing. One teammate, 30, tells me that she might want to be a Pilates teacher. Everyone else says,
I haven't thought about that.
So Yoon only plays, she tells me, because her father wants her to. I like drawing and reading books. I don't really like soccer, she says. Soo Jung says she started playing soccer because it made sense financially for her family. Soccer's housed and fed her since she was 12 years old. Minso is 29 and plays for the money. Her sister works in her parents' restaurant and makes only $6 an hour. Outside of training, we have much of the day to ourselves around the dorms, for individual training or for sleeping. We eat three meals a day together, boarding the bus every few hours to eat at local restaurants. If I walk around with a backpack on, I get asked,
Georgia, where are you going?
As though I might be escaping. A A college friend who lives in Seoul comes to one of my games. We're playing at Hyo-Chang Stadium in the heart of Seoul. It can seat just over 15,000 fans. Tonight is raining, so the usually small crowd is reduced even more. Maybe 50 people are scattered in the stands. I find my friend after the game ends. She hugs me, congratulates me on the win, and then asks what it feels like to perform for no one, to play in an empty stadium full of echo. Does it ever feel sad? Love what you do, and you'll never work a day in your life. In Korea, training is repetitive. Creativity gives way to rote technique and habit formation. Measures of progress are very small. The language barrier isn't a problem during practice once I can remember all the patterns of our passing drills. My teammates are impressed by how quickly my confusion has subsided. But memorization isn't language. It doesn't require any real understanding. We play our home games in a town called Hwacheon, almost 3 hours from where we live. The northernmost part of the area is only 9 kilometers from the demilitarized zone, the border between North and South Korea. Our stadium is the smallest in the league. Come 7 p.m. when our games start, the young soldiers fill the grandstand. They cheer and clap and break my name down into a convenient 3 syllables that make up the Korean spelling on the back of my jersey. Cho Jia. Claire's parents work together for a company that collects recycling from businesses. Since she started playing in Korea, she's made more money than them. But she is unhappy here. When she expresses her unhappiness, her father tells her to stick with it. The money is too good, and her life isn't all that hard. Do you like your job? She asks him. No. Why do you do it? I don't have any other choice. John, my soccer coach during a couple of formative teenage years, taught us how to salsa dance at a tournament in Las Vegas. He told us that he had once played professionally. I remember him saying that money ruined it for him. Money stopped it being fun for him. Money cost him the companionship of his teammates and the ease with which he had once played among them. A shameful thought surfaces. When the fight is over for equal pay, what might we lose?
That's Georgia Klopfel reading her essay, The Shape of a Dream Can Expand and Shrink, An American Soccer Life in South Korea. It was originally published by Howler. The audio version was produced by Tressa Versteg. We'll have music credits at onlyagame.org. In the fall of 2017, Norway's national team made headlines.
The women started receiving the same match fee as the men. It took a reallocation of some of the budget at the federation, but also the men agreeing to give up some of their match fees so that the women could earn the same.
So why is the best player in Norway still refusing to play in the World Cup? The answer is coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
When's the last time you had a really good workout? Not of your biceps, but of your brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of Hidden Brain. Listen every week and flex your mind.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the story of how Yogi Berra's tough love helped his son Dale. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
We don't usually start this segment with talk of women's soccer, but this is a special week, right?
Right. You have the Women's World Cup, and the United States is the favorite, which means everybody's targeting them.
Well, I mean, this year, some people are saying that the United States is not quite the favorite. They're better described maybe as co-favorites, along with tournament host France. Are you cheering for parity, or are you cheering for the good old US of A?
You know, I'm rooting for good games. I hope the United States wins.
Yeah.
I'm rooting for games that will sell this sport even further than it is sold now, because it's really a remarkable success story.
Absolutely. Of the courtside fan who shoved him during Game 3 of the NBA Finals, Raptors guard Kyle Lowry said, quote, "Fans like that shouldn't be allowed in there. I hope they ban him from all NBA games forever." Afterwards, we learned that the fan in question was Warriors minority investor Mark Stevens, which makes it so, so much worse, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you can't have this. I mean, it's bad enough the NBA sells seats practically to the midcourt line, but you can't have patrons shoving athletes. That's how that craziness started the Palace back in the day.
Well, the Warriors banned Stevens for the rest of the finals. Then the league and the Warriors suspended him for all of next year and fined him $500,000. Some are saying he should be forced to sell his shares. Do you agree?
I think it would be a good thing for all concerned if he were. Either put that guy in a padded luxury box or get him the heck out of the arena.
LeBron James was watching that game on TV, but he took to Instagram to make the point that the league needs to do more to protect players. LeBron said that if Lowry had reacted to defend himself against Stevens, fans would be calling for Lowry to be suspended for the rest of the finals, maybe even jailed. Is he right?
He's absolutely right. Maybe Kyle Lowry should have cleverly slew-footed the guy.
Well, we are going to get to the slew foot in just a bit. But I was actually confused by the fact that people were referring to Stevens as a minority investor instead of a minority owner until I saw a report from TMZ of all places about a rather quiet push in the NBA to move away from the word owner. Why is that happening and what do you make of it?
Well, because Draymond Green made a not altogether unreasonable point that, you know, we haven't allowed one set of people to own another set of people in this country since 1865. You can argue that this is political correctness run amok. I wouldn't. I think it's perfectly fine if they start calling them whatever they call them instead of owners.
All right. Back to the slew foot. What do you make of referee Kelly Sutherland's swallowing of the whistle in Game 5 of the NHL Finals?
If you want to know what a slew foot is, watch the video. You'll never see a clearer example of what it is. Basically, you leave your leg behind so a guy will trip over it. Bruin Noel Acciardi, who was the victim of the slew foot, went over backwards, which is the worst way to fall on ice, hit his head. Now he's in the concussion protocol. And Bruins coach Bruce Cassidy went up the wall about it, and he should have. This has been a swallow your whistle series. I mean, there are old-time hockey fans who once loved it, but there's a lot of stuff going on out there that's genuinely dangerous.
Last month, Tom Brady filed two requests with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to trademark the name Tom Terrific. So what's the problem?
I don't know, because I think forgotten 1960s cartoon shows should be respected down through the years. Oh, we're not talking about that. We're talking about Tom Seaver, right?
We are.
I could sing the jingle for you, by the way. If you
there was really a TV show?
It was called Tom Terrific, and Manfred the Wonder Dog was his companion. I'm Tom Terrific, the greatest hero ever. And that's where Tom Seaver got it from. So you learn things here on Only a Game. And by the way, you can find full episodes of the Tom Terrific cartoon on the YouTube.
I'm going to look it up right as soon as we're done here.
Okay.
Brady's response to the controversy is that he filed for the trademark protections to stop anyone from calling him by that name. Was there a crush of people trying to force this nickname on him?
You know, in his later years, Tom has become a little bit inscrutable. If somebody calls him Tom Terrific on the street, is he going to sue that person? I'm sure there's a branding thing here somewhere.
And finally, Charlie, we have a new world record, and that new world record is...
sports! Young Anne-Marie Vansel, who was 20 minutes old when this happened, she got to sit in the Stanley Cup.
And she's the youngest person ever to do so.
I would like to know how many, like, adults have tried to sit in the Stanley Cup before we make a big deal of this. They had a watch party, apparently, in the labor room.
Uh-huh.
And the NHL brought the cup over. And there are lovely photos of little Anne-Marie snoozing away in the bowl of the cup.
Charlie Pierce joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
I'm Tom Terrific, greatest hero ever. Terrific is the name for me, 'cause I'm so clever.
We started this show with a story about the women's national team and its fight for equitable pay. But now I want to talk about another team playing in this Women's World Cup, and that team is Norway.
On a level playing field at last. The Norwegian women's football team have just secured a world first off the pitch, becoming the first female national team to receive the same pay deal as their male counterparts.
For the record, Iceland was actually the first country to pay its men's and women's teams equal salaries, but Norway's announcement was still a pretty big deal.
It took a reallocation of some of the budget at the federation, but also the men agreeing to give up some of their match fees so that the women could earn the same.
That's Joshua Robinson. He covers European sports for the Wall Street Journal. So here's how the deal went down. In the fall of 2017, the Norwegian Players Association, which represents both the men's and women's team players, asked the Norwegian Football Association, or FA, to increase marketing money for the women. Instead, according to the head of the Players Association, the FA said, quote, "Wouldn't it be a good signal if we did things equally?" The men's team agreed to take a small pay cut, and the women's salaries nearly doubled. So why would Norway's FA take this step, making a concession the union hadn't even asked for? Well, you could argue that they did it because of this woman.
Norwegian striker Ada Hegerberg, who could win back-to-back trebles this year if her side...
Ada Hegerberg, you play in France now with Lyon. How is the first week's going?
Ada Hegerberg, widely considered the best striker in the world, who refuses to play for the national team.
Hegerberg, I suppose we should actually start by deciding how to pronounce this name. Ada
Hegerberg.
So when did you first hear that name? When and how did she sort of come onto the scene?
Well, she's anyone who follows women's football and indeed football in Europe, Hegerberg's name has been around for at least a couple of years.
Oh, l'enchaînement.
Quel décalage avec Hegerberg.
Tricky ball played into the box, header. Perhaps a chance for Hegerberg.
Hegerberg qui va lever son ballon.
She's been tearing it up for Lyon, which is one of the most dominant teams, not just in women's soccer, but in sports in the world. They've won over 10 straight league titles in France. In fact, in the 4 years that she's been at Lyon, she's only failed to win one tournament that the team was entered in. She has more trophies than any player could ever imagine by the age of 23. And last winter, she also made a splash when she won the first Ballon d'Or. It was a momentous night.
Mesdames et messieurs, Ada Hegerberg!
The Ballon d'Or is a prize awarded by a French soccer magazine over the last half century for the best player in the world. And there has always been a men's award. And last year, for the first time, they awarded it to the Women's Player of the Year, and that was Hegerberg. She was the clear favorite and the clear choice for it. And unfortunately, what happened was, in this bizarre and kind of insulting moment, a French DJ who was hosting the ceremony asked her, "Do you know how to twerk?"
Est-ce que tu sais twerker?
Non.
I think everyone in the room's jaw kind of hit the floor. No one knew quite what to make of this, and she put him right in his place and said, "No."
And as you say, this twerk thing really sort of interrupted her message, which turned out to be a very lovely message.
I would like to end this speech.
Je vais terminer ces quelques
words
mots
to young girls
en m'adressant
all over the world.
Aux jeunes filles partout
Please
dans le monde.
Believe in yourself.
S'il vous plaît.
I want to go back a bit. Ada Hegerberg first came onto the international scene through her national team, right? Which she started playing for when she was, what, 16?
Yeah, she was a young teenager when she first broke through into the national team. Already her talent was clear. Hegerberg's been in a challenging position with the national team ever since the Euros 2 years ago.
Norway in real danger of being eliminated. Can the elder, the Chelsea player, do it? No, she can't.
Norway crashed out, a historically good team, Norway, but they crashed out without so much as a goal or a victory in the group stage, and that was enough for her. She left the team and decided that the conditions of the national team were not geared for high performance or geared for excellence, and that it was a question of respect for the women's national team, which historically has been much more successful than the men's national team in Norway. Norway was starting from a place that was already much more egalitarian than most countries with respect to women in sports and women's sports funding. And yet she still felt that things weren't quite right. So she stepped away. It was huge news in Norway.
So Hegerberg stepped away from the team in August of 2017. And it was just a couple of months later in October that Norway announced that equal pay deal. But that wasn't enough to bring her back. It sounds like for her, it's not really about the money.
No, I don't think it's about the money. I think it's a question of attitudes that she perceived within the whole national team setup. From the federation side, they're pretty hopeful that someday she might reconsider. She's only 23 and she's got a long career in front of her. And it is slightly galling for them to know that the best player in women's soccer is from their country and won't wear the jersey. So the conversation is expected to resume after the World Cup. But for now, Hegerberg is perfectly content to focus on her club soccer in France.
As the Women's World Cup approached, the spotlight was always going to be on Hegerberg and her decision. But 3 weeks ago, in the Champions League final, she reminded everyone what Norway was going to be missing in this tournament, right?
She couldn't have timed it better.
And Hegerberg slots in their second, easy as you like, once again.
So it was Lyon from France, the defending champions of France, against Barcelona, the best team in Spain. And they met in the final in Budapest in the national stadium. There were more than 20,000 people in the stadium, which is a huge attendance for women's soccer in Europe.
Madri finds Hegerberg. It's three.
She scored a hat trick in the space of 30 minutes in the first half.
And Leona running away with this 4-0.
She burst through the screen. I mean, she was unbelievable to watch.
But interestingly enough, the Norwegian national team has been doing pretty well without Hegerberg too, right?
Yeah, they've progressed over the last 2 years. I mean, certainly they couldn't do any worse than they did at the Euros, but they're in a tough group at the Women's World Cup, and it includes one of the pre-tournament favorites and host, France. It hasn't been easy for Hegerberg either. I mean, this is not a decision she took lightly, and from people close to her that I've spoken to, it's one she's grappled with for a long time, but that she is at peace with right now. It really is no small thing to give up the biggest stage in women's soccer to stick to your guns.
And is this stand she's taking likely to have an impact, or are we all just going to forget about it once the games really get going?
I think the fact that we're talking about it is already showing that there is an impact. And her absence will be felt at the tournament. Every time Norway trots out there, we're going to hear about Hegerberg not being there. But it is a wake-up call for more than Norway. The fact that this is happening at what will be probably the most watched Women's World Cup in Women's World Cup history, because every tournament beats the last, it acts kind of as a megaphone for her message. And I think that others will pay attention and, you would hope, take a hard look at themselves and how they run their federations.
Joshua Robinson is based in France, where he covers European sports for the Wall Street Journal. We'll have a link to his article on Ada Hegerberg at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.